Hey up, how are you? It is another episode of the Edge of Futurist podcast. Thanks for joining us. It's episode 231 official of the main podcast. Apparently, we always have a bit of a debate about this. Of the official one, we've done more than 231, but these are the official ones that have got numbers. We did ones we outnumbered before. We've done ones we've been like vault ones, and so we've done about 300
books, and I'd say 10,000 at least then.
10,000, yeah. 10,000 hours and all that jazz. Steve, how are you, sir?
Good. I'm good. It's been a busy week. I've been at home this week, which is nice. I was in Basingstoke the week before. Obviously, the travel chaos of snow and everything else. And then now into 15 degrees. I'm not sure if spring's arrived. It feels lovely. Ben, you brought the sunshine back with you. But it's been a good week. Intense. I thought it'd be a little bit quieter, but used the opportunity to catch up on some stuff. But it's been good. Yeah, really, really heavy into some stuff. And are we allowed to say it, Ben? We're taking a different step.
Yeah, we are.
We're going to be.
It will have already happened by the time this goes.
Yeah, it will. Yeah, sorry, that thingy cat that you always mention.
Schrodinger's cat. Yeah, there it is.
I should listen to what you say, but that cat, I always say the cat in the box. Do you know if you don't, it's not as a gift that Ben gives his family, but Schrodinger's cat. It will have already happened. I know, I pronounced that right. What's happening? I must have had my the word of the day toilet papers really kicking in. But yeah, so when this airs, we'll have done our first official PD support. So we're now interviewing guests for somebody's PD day. We're going to be kind of comparing it and also hosting some panels and stuff like that. So it's a new kind of, is it a product? Is it offering? It's a new thing that me and Ben are doing. If you've got staff development days in enterprise or education and you want to kind of pull it together and have those guests feel that they've been interviewed and have something extra in a different way and a different medium and mode for your staff to listen to rather than just sitting and watching, that they can go away and they can come back and pick some bits up after. So we're excited. Long travel, won't say where it is, but me and Ben are going to be in the car on a road trip. Max and Paddy on the road to nowhere kind of springs to mind.
Exactly what was just going to come out of my mouth then. Going on a road to nowhere. Here we go.
Yeah. But you're looking brown, Ben. What's going on?
Well, I haven't been on sunbed or I've been drinking gravy. I have been to Tenerife. It has been a wonderful week. I arrived back at about 1:30 a.m. yesterday and went to bed for a few hours and then got straight into working today. So this is the second to last session for today. But yeah, we've had a great time. Just a family, wife and two children off on, been sunny. It's been an average of about 23 degrees, so we haven't had any rain. I'm feeling refreshed, read some good stuff. Feel ready to go, raring to go. And I'm excited about today's guest as well. So we've got, waiting patiently in the background, we have Will Goldsmith, who's going to come on, and I'll let Will tell you a little bit about himself and do his intro. Will, thanks for joining us on the Edge of Futurist podcast.
Oh, thanks, Ben, and thanks, Steve. Great to be part of the chat. I've been a fan for a long time, so I can't quite believe I'm here. And unlike you, I've been away, but not anywhere sunny, so I'm looking very pale. Paris was as grey and wet as the rest of Northern Europe, so no town for me, but still, nice to be away. I suppose you want me to tell you a bit about myself. I'm the head of a school called Beedales, which is an independent school in the southeast of England in Hampshire. I actually trained way back in 2005, so I think maybe before either of you. I trained in a comprehensive school in London, and then I worked in another comprehensive school, and then moved out to Leafy, Buckinghamshire, where it's the grammar system. So I was 5 years in a grammar school, and then I did. So that was my sort of first half of my career, and then I moved over to the dark side, where I then worked in a private boarding school, a London private day school, and then now I'm at Beedales. So a kind of a game of two halves. I trained as an English teacher, my degree's from Edinburgh. I used to be a TEFL teacher in Paris, that's why I know Paris so well. I kind of fell into being a head slightly by accident. in that I wasn't necessarily thinking about being ahead, but various circumstances meant that happened quite suddenly. COVID's been quite a turbulent time. For the last 3 years, it's just been a roller coaster ride of headship and just really getting into the kind of the swing of things. But I do feel very much at home in Beedales. It feels like I've waited my entire career to get to this place, and it feels like I've been there a lot longer than 3 years.
Love it. It's great to have you on. And we were just talking before we went on air as well that despite your accent, you are, and your family's northern. You're a northerner, so we're always pleased to speak to fellow northerners. Not against anybody in the south, but we know if it's cold outside, it's just a big coat job. It's not like we can't go outside, you know. So it's actually I'm sat here in shorts. I use Steve's as well, and he definitely won't have socks on either. You haven't got socks on, have you, Steve? He's got socks on. Oh, if anybody's watching,
oh, wow.
He's got socks on. This is this is a very.
Can't believe I just lifted my leg up on camera. Not sure why I did that. Should have said yeah. Maybe at least we're not video recording. Yeah, at least there's no video attached to this.
Oh, yeah, there recording. Is. Yeah, there is. Steve.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
Interestingly, though, the fact that you've got socks on is, I think this is a significant day in the life of the podcast, the life of Stephen Hall. What is it? Is it Christmas or something?
No, for anybody who knows, I don't wear socks apart from when I'm training. So if I'm training, if I'm running, if I'm doing anything like that. So in a bit of a training mode, I've got a 10-miler in a couple of weeks. So I was like, I just need to get out and do some bits. So just looking after the core today. Did some running last night, so yeah, you'll only see me in socks when it's a training day. Generally, other than that, if I'm out and about, rolled up trousers or crop trousers and no socks is potentially what I'm known for, but also what I'm mocked for, I would say, most often. But yeah,
fair enough. Well, it's not all about you, Steve. You're not the guest on the podcast.
Is it not about me? What's going on in the world?
So thank you for your introduction, Will. And I know that, like we said, you're northern. You've got family in Sunderland and above, and actually in Scotland. So you couldn't be more north. So you can be our talking person who's more northern. When Dan used to be on, he was from Newcastle, so he used to say that we weren't really northerners, that we were Midland, from the Midlands, but you're from even more north. So we found out a little bit about you through seeing a well publicized article that came out and has been a conversation around the work that you're doing at Beedales, which is the opportunity for students to, if the phrase was, you're scrapping GCSEs, which isn't technically true, is it? So we'll I know you'll get to understand that in a moment, but have that conversation about what you're doing as a head teacher that's kind of brought that into the fore, if that's all right. If you can tell us a little bit about the context of that.
Yeah. So, this is actually not news in a way, in that we actually started this process about 17 years ago. So the first, what we call Beedales Assessed Courses, so which are the equivalent to a GCSE, started with very similar headlines, actually, to what we've had recently, the whole kind of scrap thing. But basically, all you do in this kind of context is learn about how newspapers swing stories, which is to make them sound much more dramatic than they actually are. And then obviously, I mean, you always raise your head above the parapet a little bit nervously. I'd said to the guy I work with, Rob, who does a lot of the comms stuff for me, I was like, you know, it'd be really nice if we got, you know, a mildly favourable headline in the TES or some kind of specialist, you know, education website. So, you know, to go that national was not necessarily what we were aiming for. And it was quite kind of, you know, we were holding on tight as we went through it. But yeah, basically, we were just sort of telling people that we were moving to the next stage. So we currently do a kind of 50-50 model where we do, our students do about 5 or 6 GCSEs, and then the remaining kind of 5 or 6 subjects are our own BACs. The kind of core GCSEs are what you'd expect, so English, language, maths, 2 or 3 sciences, and a language. a modern foreign language. And then the others are kind of English Lit, Art, Design, Digital Game Design, which is a computer science course, but which kind of blends various different aspects of kind of game theory, coding, and also kind of world creation. So that's quite an interesting one. And a kind of global perspective one that mirrors a subject with the same name at A level. And yeah, we basically made the announcement both to our parents and our students and our staff, but also, I suppose, to the wider world, with a specific reason that we're going to be moving gradually and carefully, not suddenly, towards a two GCSE model. So it's not actually about scrapping, it's about reducing. It's about phasing down so that we're redressing the imbalance that we see currently in the system. So within about kind of 3 to 5 years, then all of our students will have got down to a two GCSE diet, with the remaining eight or so being our own internally assessed but externally moderated courses.
If we were on radio now, we'd have fanfare music, I think. You know, if we were on Radio 1, we'd have a round of applause. I love it. Mm-hmm. I think a couple of things that spring to mind. Bold leadership. Do you know, not bald. Bold leadership. I think taking that decision, but taking that step in terms of the tailored approach. But also, like you said, it's a polarizing subject, isn't it? You know, education is you know, there's generally not many people that honestly behind the scenes would sit on the fence. Yeah, you there's a lot of people that have opinions on both sides, but ultimately, sometimes the most opinionated people are those that are against some of the changes or literally are trying to fight the tide of change, which is often the case in many things. But so bold leadership, but also that step to announce it to the parents and say, look, you know, ultimately, especially for a fee-paying school, the challenges for a school like an independent school is, it says, oh, it must be so much easier. Well, it's not. It's just the expectation of parents and the people within it are just different. That actually it comes a complexity of, well, if we can pay for the education of our young people and someone's daughters or guardian people that we're responsible for to go anywhere, well, we can move them anywhere. Yes, there's some complications around that. So making that decision actually sometimes is much more of a difficult one in leadership in or I would see it as, because parents can then just say, you know what, no, it's not for me. I'll pay for them to go somewhere else and to take that step. But what has been the opinion? So let's go back to that post, not the national bit, but when you first started talking about it, I'm guessing lots of people have engaged in and communicated directly to you or on social media around it. What's that been like?
I mean, internally or kind of within the school community itself, then you've got parents who've already bought into a school where it has a tradition of doing things differently. I mean, Beadells has been an early adopter since its inception of kind of progressive approaches in education. And I suppose you've got to be a bit careful with that term nowadays because you get sucked into the culture wars, which is a whole other game, which I don't want to talk about today. But for us, it means just being at the forefront of progress in education. So very much in line with what you two are really interested in. So, you know, the school was one of the first to go co-ed. There were a couple before, but it was a pretty early adopter of that. We think that we have the oldest school council of any school in the UK. I think 1913 was when that was first brought on. Maria Montessori visited our junior school and was very influential on that. When she was alive, I think it was the 1920s, she came to visit. For a while, we did something called the Dalton Plan. There's still a school in New York, which is called the Dalton School, which was a kind of much more kind of hands-on and student-directed kind of curriculum and curriculum model. We did something called the Green Model. Look it up. It's all about learning languages kind of through living them and moving them. That one didn't work out so well, but it was interesting. And then, of course, we are known for being a non-uniform school and a school where the students on a first-name terms with the teachers. So there are a lot of things which, you know, some of those things are really common now. So like the idea of having a student panel interview, especially actually in the state sector, is quite common now. School councils are pretty much ubiquitous, I'd say. But again, we've been hopefully ahead of the curve, and in some ways that's kind of our identity. So parents who want to come to us, and they do so from kind of all over the place. So all corners of the UK, but also, you know, from as far away as California or far away as Bali, they come to us because they know they won't find an approach like ours pretty much anywhere else, and they really like it. So we've already got people bought in, and as I said, we're already halfway down the line of the movement towards the two GCSEs. So this wasn't like news. This was just like a further progression. We did have to do a kind of information evening quite soon after the headlines, partly just because the headlines were vaguely kind of mischaracterizing what we were trying to, well, we're boldly mischaracterizing what we were going to say. I'm not going to be euphemistic about it. So we did have to kind of reassure people it wasn't quite as dramatic or kind of cliff edgy as it said. And then externally, actually, the vast majority of people actually have been really, really positive. And it isn't as polarizing maybe as some people think it is. Like, I mean, even as mainstream media, something like the Jeremy Vine show, they couldn't find anyone to say anything negative about it, except for one caller who based on the fact he was talking about national service when he did it. So he must be in his kind of 60s or 70s or maybe 80s. He was the only person who was against it. And his argument was, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I'm not sure he was necessarily talking from a place of understanding. But everyone else was like, just bring it on. These are things which had their place. They were good at the time. There was a reason why we brought them in. It's not about saying it wasn't a good idea. And it's not about saying that young people aren't working hard or trying in any way to do that down. But we are at a point now where we need to think about the next evolution. And that's what this is about.
Yes. You can see us both nodding and smiling and doing wide eyes, because we're thinking to ourselves, like, we've talked numerous times, me and Steve probably more than most, about, is it possible to do school different? Is it possible to do colleges different? Is it actually possible to a space where the tail doesn't wag the dog, where there's still play, where there's still fun, there's still creativity, a place where it isn't about a regimen of authoritarianism and somehow they've got to learn standards, because if you don't learn standards by wearing uniform or by walking on the left or that, and actually, just on a little side note, I've got two daughters, one in primary school, one in high school. I tell similar stories regularly. About 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, I had a conversation with both of them about, said, do you think we should homeschool? And they were like, really? Well, I miss my friends. That's the reality is, missing friends is the bit that they didn't want to leave school for. If I said to Niamh, I said, if you could still see your friends every day or every other day, would you consider it? That's my eldest. And she was like, 100%, I hate it. Well, I don't understand why they're just so bothered about how long my skirt is and whether I've got makeup or earrings on, or whether they just want us to drill and we've got to do this in this way. And like my homework, why have I got that homework? I can do that. Why do you make, so, and I know that we could, that's not decrying a particular school. It's a system that's created, that's meant that uniforms, all those are the things that you're playing with or have played with and that aren't news anymore for you. Look, there's a culture that's set into that. And that's really what my little waffle was about. There's a culture that you've created or that has been created by governors and founders of the school and parents and teachers that have done this before. What do you think it is that's underpinning that culture that means that you can build a school without having those things that are part of the system that you can change differently?
I suppose maybe it's sort of three sort of different things. One, it has to be underpinned by maybe a higher level of respect than you'd find in a school, in a system where you have to, for sometimes good reasons, create automatic modes of respect or authority. So we have to work almost harder on respect and relationships in order to bind the community together and to make sure that, you know, I mean, you're still talking about human beings. You're still talking about, you know, in the senior school, you're still talking about adolescents and they don't always get it right. So, you know, we actually, I mean, I spend more time, and it's not just because I'm ahead, I spend more time talking about rules at Beedale's than I've ever done at any other school that I've worked in. Because in other places, it's like, you broke this rule, this is the consequence, boom. And you know, as a good teacher, you'll still have those good conversations, but at Beedale's sometimes it might take up to half an hour, sometimes even for kind of minor things. And for us, that's actually something we want to embrace, because that's about young people learning about consequences. It's learning about why you have rules. And sometimes if we have rules that they think are rubbish, and they present us with arguments as to why they're rubbish, then we might, and sometimes do, reconsider our rules and rewrite them and rewrite our policies, because actually they've given us some information which we can take on board and process and then go, that's a good idea, let's make that change. I suppose that's helped also by scale. So a bit like the XP schools in Doncaster and Newcastle, then you've got a kind of senior school, which is 500 and kind of capped at that number. We have a kind of local authority cap in terms of the local transport plan, but we kind of embrace that. And we don't want to go above it, because actually, I mean, you know, studies show that 500 is the size of an ideal village. It's the number of people you can keep in your head as a single human being. And it just means that everyone knows each other. And in knowing each other, then you don't need, again, automatic kind of modes of control, because you know, if someone's being silly, then everyone knows who they are, and they can call them by their name and say, "Oi, Johnny, what are you doing?" kind of thing. And then I suppose the other thing is the kind of it's not non-hierarchical, because we're not a fully democratic school like somewhere like Summerhill, you know, that famous school where the students and teachers are on a level. We are more democratic, and I suppose maybe we do spend a lot of time on democracy and student voice, but it's a representative democracy, and it isn't one which necessarily always calls the shots. But we definitely work hard to try and remove what we see as unnecessary hierarchies. So things which get in the way of us just being human beings together. And yes, obviously, I'm a head teacher. I'm 45 years old. I've got some experience. I've got some training. And I've got some responsibilities which my students don't have. But at the same time, if they want to stop me in the corridor and say, "Will, why is it that, I don't know, the showers and the changing room aren't working at the moment?" They don't do so in a kind of angry or disrespectful way, but they do so in a way that then I'll be like, "You know what? I've just been talking about this morning, you know, with the head of facilities. And we were just saying how we've got to get that fixed. And so they're going to be done next week," or whatever. And regularly students will come to see me and have those conversations. And just that sense in which they are co-curators of our community, it is a really crucial way of binding us together. And for us, it's part of their education. It's not just what happens in the classroom. It's also more broadly what they learn about being a member of a mini society, because when they leave us, they're going to go out to a much bigger one, but they'll have practiced the skills of being kind of, you know, active members of a smaller society.
Love that last sentence. Because when you are a part of a class, when you're part of a group, when, yes, you can apply that to the context of work potentially, or your next steps, because you're then going to be part of a similar size organization, unless you go to a big, but still you're working in your bit of mini silos. But I think what you've just said there is actually how can you transition not just education to next steps or work, how can you transition that co-creation, that community feel, to the community outside, whether that's ongoing actually as they develop as young people, or obviously when they become adults. I think it's something that's vital, really, because I think, you know, during COVID, we maybe took some steps back because those interactions, those social abilities were lost at times. And some of the behaviour problems that people do mention and things like that are often attributed to that, and the ability to socialise and develop those skills. So, fascinated. And you said, obviously, internal, the behaviour stuff and everything else, but you also said there wasn't any backlash in regard to that. Has there been any people that have, I'm just trying to think about the Agora School. Agora School is a school in the Netherlands, and they say, "We're not a zoo." Imagine, Joe, when you put yourselves and you put your heads above the parapet and you say, "This is what we're trying to achieve." Is it where people say, "Can we come and visit?" And either, you know, to be proven that it can't work, or proven that, "Oh, this is what we want to step into." What does that work look like for you as head and the school?
I mean, we're super busy, and luckily it's not just me. Loads of my colleagues and I, we welcome people. You know, we have visitors every week to the school. It is very much something which we feel as a school, and I'm not saying that every independent school necessarily does this, but certainly as far as we are concerned, we feel our value is not only to our students and our community, but is also to the wider educational community, whether that be in the independent sector, because sometimes I might ask some challenging questions of my colleagues in maybe more traditional schools, or even just my presence sometimes can problematize some people, and happily so. I'm happy being that person. But then also, the state-funded sector and beyond. Like, we have conversations with people. We have visitors from New Zealand. We have visitors from Sweden. We have visitors from all over the UK all the time, and we really enjoy that dialogue. We have academics who come to visit us, and it's not, we're not trying to say we're doing everything right, nor are we trying to say that what we do is what everyone else should do. That kind of arrogance is definitely not what we're doing. But we are here to say, look, there are different ways of doing things from the way that you are currently doing things. There are paradigms that you can consider, which aren't necessarily about throwing everything out, but are potentially about thinking about things relatively radically, but still within the framework of a caring and thorough and rigorous education. And in some ways, like, as an independent school, we have funding levels which you won't find in the state sector, particularly at the moment. And then also we have a freedom that you're never going to get in the most enlightened and liberated and trusted state sector anywhere in the world. Will never have the freedoms that you'll find in the independent sector. And, there are lots of arguments about equity, and I'm very sensitive to those. And I think there are a lot of strong arguments in favour of some kind of recalibration. But at the same time, we do have this sector in the UK, which is different from other countries, and it is recognised internationally. We've got loads of kind of British connected international schools, which, form a significant part of, an export kind of product, which has value to the country, and we don't have that many other exports, and it does seem to fit where we are as a nation, and it kind of connects with quite a proud tradition of us really thinking about education really deeply. And so I feel like BDELs and other independent schools' job is to be part of a conversation to maybe allow us to go off and do stuff, and then say, look, here we are. We've done this in this context, and yes, it's a differently funded one, and we've got different kind of kids, and it's different context. But it can be done. How about we work with other sectors to scale this up? And we regularly have people from all sectors who come to visit us and who take bits of what we do, and we like that.
Yeah, I love that as well. I think that's really important. That there's probably things that you would take out of you've had a comprehensive teaching background that you bring in, and then there's also that element of how that there's a cross-pollination that can happen as well. And I think that's really healthy. I don't think we should have a one-size-fits-all. And the irony of it all is that comprehensivization was, as a concept, was in trying to make it universal. Everybody does the same thing. There's a national curriculum that everybody has to follow. And none of us are necessarily suggesting that national curriculum or national curricula, because there are numerous ones, are should be scrapped totally. There's a lot of value in that. But interestingly, there's got to be a space in what we do as educators to have that creative freedom, flexibility. We've got to have autonomy and or a level of agency at least for our staff, and also our students. I love that it felt a little bit strange. I'm not going to lie to you. When you just said that a student catches you in the corridor and says, "Will, why are the showers not working?" I was like, "Will? Like, is he not?" like, and I know you just said it a minute ago that they could call you back. Like, this is almost like a foreign language to a lot of educators, because what we're talking about here is not a command, like you said. It's not a commanded respect. It's not a, like, because my position is here, that means that everybody must automatically call me by that name or by that. Interestingly, I had a conversation with my elders the other day again, and said, you're going to say sir at the end of your sentences to me, please. And she like looks at me as if to say, like, are you on a different planet? There's no chance. I don't even call me teacher, sir. So, like, never mind you. And she's not a rebel, really. But I think what I really like about this is that what you're saying is there is a different way, and we can all learn from each other. And it's not a one size fits all. We've been proponents, as you'll know, of this. One size fits all means actually one size fits none. Trying to force every student down a certain pathway that has to be that way, and I really like that. But that doesn't necessarily mean chaos, does it? It means that there is still regularity, and there is still expectation. And like you said, if parents are paying for their students, interesting, you said the phrase differently funded, because every organisation is funded, every school's funded. It's just where that funding's coming from. So in terms of taking that into a conversation, then in terms of what that then really looks like, then could you tell us a little bit about your assessments and what they look like and how they're different, and what that might look like in terms of why that's different from a GCSE.
So I mean, firstly, the kind of the inception was, particularly for our cohorts, we basically are preparing Key Stage 4 kids for an A-level curriculum at sixth form. So we don't teach T-levels and we don't teach BTECs. So there's an extent to which, you know, we are limited in terms of what we're doing for the last 2 years of senior school. And as such, you know, there's a kind of narrower funnel there. So one of the things we're looking at is kind of looking at, okay, well, how are we preparing them for that pathway? And as you said, GCSEs are a general certificate of secondary education for all pathways. So it's about tailoring things more towards that. We also felt that actually there was an excessive level of kind of centralized control over content, over assessment methodology. And you know, it was a conservative thing initially, but then it was a new Labour project and it was taken over by, you know, Gove and Cummings. So, you know, it straddles both sides of the major parties in terms of that desire to kind of take control, whether that was driven by good things or ill, that's for another discussion. We also looked at the kind of university model. So if you go to, you know, the University of Manchester, they don't have like an AQA Manchester degree in maths. They don't go to AQA and get them to write their degree. They're professors of maths. They're subject experts. They know their subject. They also know about assessment, and they know their students, and they know their context. And so they write their own degree. But obviously, it's not as simple as just writing your own degree. You've got to have someone check it. So they have external moderators, normally from another university and people who kind of know what they're talking about, who hold them to account. So we use the same model. So they are internally written, internally assessed with, you know, kind of a rubric and a curriculum and kind of we do use kind of 9-to-1, and we did used to use A-star to U in terms of letter grading before, but partly just to kind of help the rest of the world. And to some extent, parents and students have some kind of understanding, but they are not the same as GCSEs, and they are deliberately not accredited, because the moment you accredit is the moment you bring that kind of external scrutiny to a level which then changes the stakes, but also changes the way in which students are interacting with that education. And it becomes particularly something which is, it also changes the way that parents view it and the way that teachers view it. I understand why that's there, but it's essentially pernicious. It generates a kind of intensity and an anxiety, which we see in our education system now, not just with GCSEs, but also with kind of level 3 qualifications and also with the SATs as well. It's just constant. And then obviously, if you tie that then to the to Ofsted, then woof, you know, it's a whole bundle of intensity, and we can see the consequences of that. Obviously, being in the independent sector, we are held to different standards. We have a different inspectorate, which ironically now has moved to a system where there are no single word judgments anymore. That started in September. So again, like, you've got a sector which is kind of essentially already trialing what a lot of people in the state funded sector are calling for. We're already doing that, and you know, there's a few teething problems, I think, with the new kind of ISI kind of regime, but we'll have worked those out in a year. And it's also peer assessed, so pretty much all inspectors for ISI are serving sort of leaders in schools. So again, it's a model which I know that colleagues in the state funded sector would love to have, and there's a lot of conversation about that, and I kind of sit there going, yes, of course you should, it's great, it's so much better. But anyway, So those are the courses in terms of the structure. So we basically choose, sorry, going back to the BACs, the BDELS assessed courses, we basically have the head of department and the rest of the subject sort of team working on a curriculum which they think is appropriate for a level 2 kind of age group, with obviously the pathway to A-level, but with a much greater blend of assessments. Now, some of that is just about having a balance, because we know that different people, and obviously there are different cohorts, and boys and girls, especially at 16, are really tricky cohort because of the maturity gap. So we want a mixture of both kind of terminal or high stakes assessments and more kind of coursework style things. But we can also do things like presentations and oral presentations and portfolios. And we can also bring in kind of real world aspects to things as well. So students have to do kind of within our global awareness course, they have to do kind of projects where they link it to kind of a real community or a real community course that they're connected with. And then at the end of the 2 years, that's all bundled together, the marks are added up, and then a sample of that work is externally assessed by a moderator, ironically often senior examiners for GCSE. So you know, it is all interconnected, and it's not that we're like, oh no, GCSE is rubbish, or we hate everything about assessment, or we don't like exams. It's just we don't like as many exams, and we think particularly for 16-year-olds, when you know that the maturity gap is that big, and won't narrow until they get to 18, it's almost fundamentally unfair to make it too high stakes. And then obviously, you know, they then go on to do their sixth form. One of the other things which really helps our students is that when they, and 99% of our students will apply to higher education, whether that be a kind of creative college route. So looking at, I don't know, Central St Martins or RADA or the Royal College of Music, or whether that be, you know, kind of standard kind of Russell Group type universities, like other independent schools still predominantly send their students to. On the UCAS drop-down menu, alongside GCSEs, there are also BDELs assessed courses. And so there's not some big hole of what they haven't done, because it's not recognised by UCAS. Luckily, BACs are recognised by UCAS. So that's something which we work very hard on at the beginning of this process. And that just gives students and parents a greater kind of sense of clarity and security.
Just trying to... It's a really interesting concept, that what you've just talked about. Because when those universities are being applied for, the last thing you want to do is prepare something that the external forces don't justify and say there's no next step for you. So you've got to really think about the future currently because of that step. But ultimately, those universities that are making that decision and saying, well, ultimately, it has to be UCAS or it has to be BDEL assessed courses, or if there's any others out there, are the ones who are creating their own, as you've said, because they're creating their own degree courses. Imagine flipping the coin and saying you're assessing basically what you think is appropriate to get into your organisation. If you want to send somebody on to the next step beyond you, we can't take your degree because ultimately you've written it and it hasn't been, it's not a central or general course. Like, you know, they turn around and say, hold on a second, we've been doing this for years. It's like, do as I say, not as I do. I'm not sure what you're saying here. Is it them? I'm not sure if it's the universities that are forcing it, or is it those forces such as UCAS or those awarding bodies? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to get too political and put you on the spot, but ultimately, because if you're creating your own and it's been validated by potentially a consultant or somebody that's working for something, it decentralizing it, it takes it away from a central point such as AQA and Pearson and anybody else having control of what we have to do and making a vast amount of money from it. That is potentially, based on what you've just said, the stumbling block of why one of the hurdles we have to, in the state sector, would have to get over.
There are several stumbling blocks, and obviously what we're doing would need to be scaled up, and then in doing so there would be certain ramifications. So the first thing, which, you know, has been called for several years now, is a post-qualifications applications system to higher education. Like, until we move to that, and like, if you look anywhere else in the world, people don't do it like we do it, and they think we're nuts to give an offer on the basis of a hypothesis rather than a reality. And that's before we even start talking about the problems of terminal assessments and just using those grades as the determiner as to whether you get into university or not. And there's a lot of arguments about equity when it comes to stuff like that. So, you know, that's quite an interesting one. And again, one for another day. There are other things. Yeah, I would imagine, not that we talk to them directly, it's interesting because I do talk to people. We talk all the time to people on exam boards, and they're really interested in what we're doing, and they're doing some interesting things too. They would, if GCSEs went, or if it went down to just English and maths, then a whole industry would be kind of cut out, or a whole part of that industry would disappear. So all of those kind of papers that get sent off to where it is in Peterborough or whatever, where they scan them in, and, you know, thousands of people marking them up and down the country and so on and so on. And then all those certificates being generated and all the rest of it, that would just go. If you scaled this up for the rest of the country, you would also have to re-professionalize and kind of liberate the teaching profession to be able to do this. You'd have to kind of not upskill them, because I still, you know, I come across a lot of amazing subject specialists at secondary level, but their hands are tied behind their back, because they don't get any creativity, but they also don't get any kind of possibility of tailoring things to the classes they're teaching and the kids they're teaching in the towns and communities they're teaching in. And in some ways, all they're doing is just delivering. And, you know, this is why you see an ever greater amount of kind of centralized teaching styles, or you know, you've got to teach in a certain way, you've got to follow a certain sort of teaching methodology, because it's just step by step that autonomy has been taken away. Now, you know, people will then go, well, you know, in the 70s and 80s, you know, kids could just do what they want and all the rest of it. It was permissive. And yeah, that isn't good either. But for us, certainly at BDELS, and for me as an educator, it's about balance. It's about a balance between enough of a centralized mandate that you know that there are standards which are upheld across the country, but then enough autonomy that teachers in different places with different kids can deliver the right education for those individuals. And, you know, if things are going to go in any direction, it's about being more individualized. And yet our system has become less individual than it was even 10 years ago. And that's the thing which just feels so wrong at the moment. But yeah, they would have to change things. And we would probably also, well, the Department for Education would also lose a core metric at 16, although actually we know that metric is really problematic, you know, both in terms of what it's measuring in terms of different communities, and also particularly what it's measuring in terms of differences between, on a very broad brush, girls and boys. And those things, again, you know, are kind of, you know, really, really obvious and really well known that those are difficult things, and yet we can't seem to see beyond it. So, for example, when Kasmin Birbal Singh was very critical of the announcement that we made, and she, you know, she was on the radio and there was an article, you know, there were kind of conversations about we thought our kids weren't, you know, we were trying to game the system, our kids weren't good enough. There was a sense in which we were trying to kind of get around things. Well, in some ways, we are trying to get around a system which we think is fundamentally unfair, which doesn't serve young people. But it's not like we're just doing it quietly and getting on with it and kind of pretending it's not happening. We're like, we are deliberately putting our head above the parapet to say to people, you know, we're doing this. And we know that any independent school that says anything to the public on national level will open itself up to criticisms, and rightly so. But at the same time, we did so knowingly because we feel it's a narrative that we want to share, and we think it's not just about us, it's something which is, you know, beneficial potentially for all young people, and that's kind of what drove it.
I love it. I've said it 3 times now, I think. I love it, because it feels like your decisions you're making are not just like, what should we do? It's well informed, it's at, with the students' best interests at heart. It's about thinking around the unfairness and or inequity in the system and how we can address that rather than just perpetuate that. We're hoping to have in a few months' time get Dennis Sherwood on, and Dennis Sherwood, you'll know, talks about the unfairness and how literally in the assessment scheme, at least 10% of, or some people say up to a third of qualifications are not actually true, and can be one or two grades either way wrong. Well, that's just ridiculous doing that at 16 years old, never mind anywhere else. My question is this, and I'm not sure if anybody else has asked this question, so I'll be out there. You are scaling down the use of GCSEs and building your own assessment that are rigorous, externally moderated as well. So we're in a strong position, preparing young people for A levels as opposed to T levels, vocational qualifications, in order for them to be able to go to universities, whether that is the creative universities or the Russell Britt universities or anybody else, Russell Group universities. Why stop at GCSEs?
I used that word earlier. It's about balance. Fundamentally, you know, you've got to balance the needs of your students, and if you're talking about it on a broad level, the whole country, with the reality of where we are. And we know that our students need a leaving ticket, an exit ticket, and they need that at 18. And we know that, you know, the reason why universities like GCSEs partly is because it gives them a metric to do some filtering, because they have such high numbers of applicants that they can use some numbers to get a cut score, and then people below that don't get through the first round of the application process, and some of the people above it do. So, you know, that maybe is kind of part of it, in the sense that we are pragmatic. We're not kind of some kind of completely idealistic place where it's some kind of utopia where we completely ignore the world. And certainly by the end, we do have to work hard on preparing them for, you know, the cut and thrust of A-levels and, you know, a different system when they get to university and all the rest of it. And they need to have the confidence to go out into the world where, you know, it's not as protected and sheltered a community as the one we have in our school. So, yeah, you know, that's definitely, you know, there. In an ideal world, and we just kind of launched a 10-year strategic plan, we have talked about in the second half, which you can imagine is quite vague because 5 years away from now is quite a long time and a lot's going to happen. We have talked about getting the BAC transition down to 2 GCSEs and the rest BACs done within 5 years. Then for the second 5 years, then we look at the sixth form curriculum again. Now, there's some interesting stuff happening in the IB world, where rather than the 6 courses that they do, I know that Atlantic College, which is the place where they sort of founded the IB, they are currently trialing one where rather than the 6 different subjects you have to do at IB diploma level, you do 4 which are assessed externally, and then there are 2 which are assessed internally, which are much more kind of real worldy, which have much more student agency, and kind of slightly redress the balance. And one of the reasons why, and we love the concepts of the IB, but it's quite clunky and it's very one size fits all. And like it suits some students, but it doesn't suit others. But the idea of maybe kind of reducing down the kind of that really broad spread that you're required to do in IB at the moment in the diploma, if you take that down to 4 and then give students more of a balance, again, that word is there, then that's something that we might be interested in at that point.
I can hear that. I can certainly hear that. Yeah.
So it's in the potential. The steps are in the strategy. You know, we won't hold you to it. You know, the last 12 months has been an interesting ride for since the founding of artificial intelligence. I can't believe it didn't exist before 2022, and definitely before January 2023. It's like EdTech didn't exist before COVID. All of these things have been introduced post COVID, as if. Yes, it's an interesting world now that technology exists and artificial intelligence does. So that will obviously thrust and change things. So I suppose the question on that is, do you feel, and to put you on the spot, I suppose, would the focus of where the school would be going with its reduction of GCSEs, is that made simpler because obviously you're a through school and the seniors then go on to A-levels internally? If there was a stop and you didn't have that ability and you were then preparing them for sitting those A-levels externally, do you think that would have caused greater complications and a harder step into what you're trying to achieve?
Definitely. And I think the people who've expressed the most concern internally have been people who, you know, sometimes for good reasons, you know, we do have a few people who leave at 16. You know, some kids have been with us since they were 3 years old and they just want a change of social scene, or they want to go to a college or a different setting, or they want something in the final 2 years, which, you know, is not necessarily something which is as much of a specialism for us. So, you know, that's definitely a valid concern. Now, when it comes to transferring to any independent school, it's never a problem, touch wood. But yeah, I'm not familiar with any single school that said, oh, you do these weird things with BACs, we won't let you in. The only issues that we face, and it's not an issue if they transfer internationally. We can always talk to people, and, you know, the transfer, people kind of get that it's never going to be exactly the same. And in most other systems, kids don't do high numbers of exams at 16 anymore because they don't leave school until they're 18, which is also the case in the UK and has been for the last 14 years. But we just haven't changed our system for it. That's another thing that, you know, it's a long time to shift our perception about when kids actually leave school. And yeah, I get that FE has a special place in the UK kind of ecosystem when it comes to education. But, you know, it was interesting. We were talking to a House of Lords Commission on Education, and they were talking about looking at things. It was the Commission on Education for 11 to 16 year olds. And they basically wrote themselves out of a job by saying, we think we should be looking at 14 to 19 rather than 11 to 16. And basically, we kind of agree with that. But yes, for a small number of students who do transfer out, you know, we do have to be mindful of them. And it's really only state-funded colleges and schools where sometimes we might have a little bit more work to do. So it might involve me having to kind of pick up the phone. It might involve us having to give a more detailed transcript. So of course, you know, some schools just don't know what we do, and that's fine. While we may make an occasional national headline, we don't expect people to know what we're doing necessarily, certainly not in detail. And like those principals and heads that I've spoken to have always been like, well, all I want to do is make sure that we're letting onto a course a student who's ready to do that. You know, we don't want to set them up to fail, and we completely agree with that. So we're all on the same page there. We've explored going down the ENIC route, which is essentially the International Equivalency Certificate. And initially, you know, there was some signs that would have been a positive one because we're recognised by UCAS. But basically, the DfE, I don't think, will allow that for probably some understandable reasons, because it starts to erode what they're trying to hold on to. But we are, you know, we may do some work ironically with an exam board where you can get a kind of centre accreditation, which accredits the centre, but not the courses. So it just says that, you know, you follow kind of standard assessment practices, which they're willing to give a label to. But we actually might not do any of those things and just make sure we provide a transcript. So that's also some of the other work that we're doing, which is looking at what we provide our students all the way through from 3 to 18 in terms of a much richer transcript of what they have done in education. So particularly thinking about some of the work that's done with the Mastery Transcript Consortium in America. I don't know if you've come across them before, but basically it's an organization which is working on, and they have a kind of prototype already, a much richer kind of leaving certificate for high school leavers in the US, rather than just like an SAT score or some grades in other stuff or GPA. It's basically a whole kind of transcript with lots of different things that you've done, and even with kind of like hyperlinks to like a video of you doing a performance, or like a, you know, you're able to look online at a digital portfolio. Now, obviously, that's much more labour intensive, but it's funny you should talk. Oh, my screen's just flipped. Sorry, I don't know why my iPad does this. I'll just put it back. Technology, gotta love it. But yeah, that actually with AI, what you were talking about earlier, we have the tools now to read things much more than just a few letters and a few grades. And you can do that at the touch of a button at the speed at which we used to be able to read numbers and letters. And so there is an interesting kind of evolution, I think, where we can use AI tools to access much richer data and to read those students and to assess, you know, those students when you're thinking about an employer or a university or a college.
Totally agree. I totally agree. And I think it's important that we move away from the tabulation stuff in terms of things that are a little bit more richer. It's actually that the sociologist in me talks qualitative rather than quantitative. And actually, yeah, if we could get qualitative on scale, that's what we really want, as opposed to quantity on that helps the scale. Because obviously conscious of time, we're grateful that you've given up time in your hard term as well. One of the things that I know that you're passionate about, and it's very, very clear, is about being an educator who's got conviction and who stands for things that you believe in. And one of the things is that you're an openly gay teacher and are quite open to helping people express that identity. And I wonder whether we could talk at that level as well, because I know that there's a level of conviction around the stuff that you're talking about, around developing student agency and the stuff. But what have you found in that space that you think is really important for us to share in this space?
I mean, I think again, it's about balance. Like, me being gay is a part of my identity. It's not the whole thing. There's all sorts of other things that would make up the kooky person that I might be to some people, but it is an important one, and maybe more so in a society which isn't fully accepting of you know, people who are gay and other aspects. And you know, I'm a great believer in intersectionality, so it's not just about thinking about one aspect of difference, but it's about kind of connecting with lots of different ones. So whether that's class where you're kind of class minority. So, you know, we have students on full bursaries, for example, who come through our school, who come from quite a different class background, if you're going to look at it through that lens, and kind of supporting them and making sure we're a welcoming community for them is a really important part of what we do. But, you know, going back to my sexuality, I grew up, especially in an educational context, in the 1980s and the 1990s. And during that era, then it was when Section 28 was law in this country. And, you know, people who don't know what it is, it basically prohibited schools from discussing homosexuality. I think that was the term they used in the law. And it basically banned teachers from ever being able to talk to students about being gay, amongst other things. And it made them, you know, even when they could have found a reason to do it, it made them nervous about doing so. And so I grew up without any kind of conversations about my sexuality, any conversations about kind of positive ways of that being part of your identity. Now, obviously, the 1980s and the 1990s are a very different time. And you know, there were all sorts of reasons maybe why that came in, some neutral and some very negative. But we are in a different time in the sense that our laws have changed, but attitudes are still, you know, quite patchy. And, you know, we're still, you know, being gay is not necessarily what the majority of people are or ever will be. And it's not about trying to make people gay, as a lot of the kind of arguments were, you know, to bring in Section 28 was this idea that you're going to kind of brainwash children. To, you know, it's not an easy choice when you know you're a minority, but when you're being true to yourself, then that's just who you are. You don't choose it. It just is part of you. And so, like, you know, I regularly have to out myself to people, not because I necessarily want to, but just they make assumptions about the fact that when they look at my wedding ring, they think, well, you must be married to a woman. And, you know, I can get it in the sense that the majority of people are in heterosexual relationships. And so you do need to talk about it. But I think it's particularly important in a school context, because obviously that's the point at which, especially in kind of secondary school, especially, kids are learning about who they are. They're exploring their own identity. And there's a lot of fluidity there. But I think it's really important they see role models of lots of different types, you know, whether that be, you know, people of colour who are educators, whether that be, you know, gay or lesbian or trans, you know, their teachers, whether that be people of lots of different class backgrounds, people with different accents. You know, kids need to hear lots of people to know that there's not just one size fits all in terms of leadership, in terms of success, in terms of happiness, in terms of fulfillment. And I suppose the final thing really is I work in a school where like the clothes that I wear at home are the same I wear at school. There is no difference in my wardrobe, basically. Now, that's obviously a very superficial thing, but it is a symbol, is a sign of something much more profound. And that's kind of what we try and do, which is to say we bring our authentic selves to school. And obviously, there's some things which I don't talk about or some things which I might kind of edit in terms of the detail. The last thing what the kids want to hear about is the minutiae of my holiday, you know, details and all the rest of it or whatever. But at the same time, I think they do benefit from having teachers who are authentic with themselves, you know, within professional limits. And so, yeah, you know, I don't want to hide the fact that I'm married to a man. You know, we actually, Andrew and I, we got married just in October and we did it at school. And that was, you know, a really, really amazing thing. And the school is one of the few boarding schools where I can really imagine fitting in and feeling so at home. And so our decision to get married there was very much driven by the feeling that we feel connected, we feel respected, and we feel welcomed by the community that I'm the head of and that I'm part of. And it kind of just ties in with the whole ethos. And that's really special. But yeah, it's not the only thing I talk about, far from it.
Love it. Well, we're gonna quickly move into our quickfire questions. Not that... We've tried to do this really before and we're trying to go quick fire. That's the phrase that we say to everybody. First question then is future of exams, ironically, online, traditional or scrapped? That's the only options we give.
Traditional, scrapped. If you give me one, then it's online.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Key skill students will need in 2040.
Creativity. It's the only things the machines do really badly.
And education in 50 years. What's your vision for that?
Much more blended. So the social thing, especially for teenagers, is still really important. So, you know, IRL stuff plus tech stuff. Much more tailored, much more individual than we are allowed to be at the moment. And one where probably they'll be able to assess without having to put you through an exam at all. So I suppose, yeah, by then, going back to your previous question, not at all.
Love it. Will, thank you so much for joining us on the Edu Futurist podcast today. We know that this will be one that resonates with a lot of people, lots in there, lots to, for us to unpack and unpick. Good job we've got a road trip to talk about it on Monday, Steve.
I know. Yeah. This is going to be discussed at length. We might even have to listen back. thank
you for having me. As you can tell, this is like my specialist subject for Mastermind, if I'm able to get on it. So, you know, if you want to have more chats about this whenever, then let me know. I'll probably end up boring you by talking about it so much. But no, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real treat.
No, it's thank been you. Great, Will. And as well as a road trip, Ben doesn't even know this, I've got a trip to potentially one of a space for our event in 2024 next week. So it could be where we have this conversation face to face, Will. It'd be a good one to have. So yeah, maybe watch the space in the uprising 2024 if we can get it going. I've committed to it now, Ben. You see what we've done.
Thanks, mate.
So, yeah, but to be fair, 2024, we've got quite a few months yet. We've got 10 months to get it in. So we're good. We're good. But Will, it's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Cheers.